my hand. Well, not literally, Raymond.
Here, take this drink.
Okay, I think then.
Oh, much better.
That'll free up one of my hands anyway. To fend you off.
Excellent.
Now, Thomas, you were humming something there, but I had absolutely no idea what it was.
Well, yes, probably my incredibly bad version of it. Take my hand, I'm a stranger in paradise. Again, I must turn around to the assembled crowd and say that I am actually here just reciting the lyrics of Stranger in Paradise, the hit bit of Kismet. In fact, the only bit anybody really remembers from Kismet. That's all I was doing. I mean, I spent the entire first piece there humming away the tune in my head and then trying to impose it onto Borodin, which I suppose is the terrible reversal of fate.
Something tells me you're not a Borodin fan.
I'm not a huge Borodin fan. I think it's... Whenever I see somebody that, he wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He was born with a gold-encrusted, jewelled, fur-lined spoon in his mouth.
Fur-lined spoon, Thomas.
Yeah, that could be worryingly nauseating. And probably that was the problem with him, I'd say, you know. So he was child to a prince, son to a wonderful pianist. I don't think we can actually complete it in a sort of formal way as we would do in Gladiator, you know, parent to a murdered child or something like that. But so he is one of these, he's a character who has had everything. And I don't mind that. But what I do mind is that he had this fantastic potential and great skill and he squandered it on chemistry.
Well, you see, I suppose he had to make a living, did he?
He did. So but off he goes and becomes professor of chemistry, and he does this as a sideline.
But Thomas,
of course I'm jealous of the man.
I get the impression that this piece of music doesn't really rock your boat.
No.
I suspect the reason, Thomas, and I have to say, taking an overview of tonight's programme, yeah, there are two great pieces and a filler. The thing about it is that we just saw it there in concert mode. But if you see it, for instance, when you have the dancing and the chorus and the music together, I think it's a different piece of music then, because it's a performance. It's not just music. There's choreography and so forth. There's the singing. I think it makes it much richer and more, shall we say, valid. But otherwise, it doesn't really rock my boat either. There's that lovely, you know, symphonic melody which you get there, but all through it I was just saying, oh, come on, where's the Prokofiev sort of thing? And then you come into this piece, I mean, the start of that Prokofiev, those, all I can describe it as, it those waves of sound surging and abating, coming stronger and stronger all the time, that massive beginning to it. It's, to me, it's a magnificent piece, written strictly speaking as one piece with three, you might say, sub-movements, but not three distinct different delineated pieces. Really magnificent piece. And I was thinking as well, Thomas, now, if you think of you know, just at the interval here, okay, we've a 20-minute interval, think of the gap between those two pieces. Like, they were separated by about, I mean, I'm talking, looking forward to the Shostakovich here, the Prokofiev written in 1912, and only about two dozen years later, the Shostakovich 5 was premiered. Two dozen years. Well, look back, that's 1990. From here back to 1990, which is distressingly close. But think of the chasm that separates them. You know, you had the First World War, you had the revolution in Russia, you had depression, you had all sorts of things, you had the Stalin's virtual reign of terror. So they're coming from immensely different backgrounds, and one coming out of Imperial Russia, one coming out of Communist Russia, and yet at the same time, what both of them do for me is they stamp something I've said to you again and again. As far as I'm concerned, the 20th century is the Russian century in classical music. I adore that Prokofiev piece, and I'm really looking forward to the Shostakovich.
Well, I'm looking forward to the Shostakovich for sure, but to me, and I think my problem with the whole evening is that the evening is not telling us what it is, and it's an evening about deception. And I keep thinking about deception when I'm seeing all of this, and every part of this feels like deception to me. So we start the Prokofiev, and it feels like it's going to be a wonderful Rachmaninoff, but certainly, we introduce it, and we think we're going to get something with high romantic elements, and then wham, it's drawn back into something completely different. And that switch is very important. The Borodin, the real problem I have with Borodin is, of course, it's probably the best piece that Rimsky-Korsakov ever wrote. and, you know, so the deception is that this bejeweled prince is really the author, and because that's what they wanted. They wanted the all-round intellectual to be presented as both capable of, this hugely fantastically important life as a chemist and as an academic and scholar. And then he can switch into this, you know, soulful connection with the peasantry of the Russian steppes with Prince Igor, from which this thing is, the dances are taken. What Borodin is he is exactly what the czarist imperial Russia wants. They want to show that somebody of noble lineage is capable of being, you know, great intellectual and associated with the West. And it was very, you know, very important to be associated with the West at that point in time. That was where they were showing their great modernity and their great advances in, you know, in culture and skill. And they'd, you know, freed the serfs, so now they were trying to join the rest of humanity. So that was very important. The fact that he's a scientist, the fact that he's a chemist and a doctor, and that he's sent off and does, you know, studies in Germany and studies all over Central Europe before coming back, that's very important to the myth of Borodin. And then he can also be this romantic, poetic soul, you know, tormented to try and get the steppes of Russia and the peasantry and their problems into music as well. In fact, just the kind of poet warrior, noble man that you want running the country. So he's an ideal foil for this. And the fact that he, of course, was actually perhaps maybe only a modestly good chemist, but had good connections and got the professorship. The fact that he really, you know, didn't complete as many works as we would like, and in fact this work was completed by Rimsky-Korsakov and Glazunov,
yeah,
as well, so that you know, and how much, of course, they're going, oh yes, well, he wrote an awful lot of it, and I remember well, he used to play it over and over to me, and they come out with this completed piece, so to complete the mythic structure for us. And then of course you've got Prokofiev, who's also part of the myth, and the myth here now is the deception, which is the Soviet Union. They want to have somebody who has a common touch, a modernist, and they've got obviously trouble with Shostakovich, as we'll see in a few minutes, but he's the ideal reformed individual. He runs away from the Russian Revolution. He, again, does not come from totally impoverished background. If you're studying in the conservatoire in St. Petersburg before the revolution, that sort of signals you out as probably not a hand-to-mouth living peasant. And then when he decides he will leave and tour Europe, it's very hard to see where he's making the money. Very hard to see where the living is coming from. But his mother is a huge influence on this and a huge help to all of this. But I think that it's the reversal. You know, what we're looking at here is his opening. And, of course, Glazunov is also involved in this because he's in the conservatoire and he's, you know, he thinks that this is he sees an important student, and she's involved with Shostakovich as well. So he's the common factor to all of these things. Then Prokofiev decides, I'm going to come back.
To the motherland.
To the motherland. I'm going to come back to the Soviet Union. And when he does, he produces a whole other body of work, which again is in some ways deceptive. Now, with Shostakovich, I think there's a whole other story going on here. And it's a story told, and very interesting story, by a man called Ian MacDonald. The thing with Shostakovich is that what we have is this desperate reversal from him being regarded very solidly as the instrument of the Soviet Union, its voice, and its voice to the rest of the world. And he travelled extensively as the voice of the Soviet Union. And then in the middle 1970s, we have a disputed and very dangerously disputed testimony, which was essentially apparently dictated by Shostakovich. And this is his biography. And this gets out, and it's hugely praised in the West. Because what it said is, it's all been a lie. I've been tortured all the time. What I've been doing is I've really been writing about the soul of Russia underneath this in my music, and that's what I've been conveying. And what I've had to do is I've had to do this and because of the regime, and I haven't been able to convey what I really want to do, you know, what I really want to convey. And I've had to do all kinds of things for these very reasons. That was then grabbed by Western classical music and indeed general sociological and political analysts as being complete proof, the I told you so, when they look at these works. That is then responded to in kind, because we're still in the middle of the Cold War, by the Soviet Union, who said, this is, you know, this is invented by the CIA. This is, you know, Dmitri Shostakovich did not dictate this at all. This is a complete and utter lie, invented to place this on the table and to undermine this great Soviet heroic figure. Shostakovich, of course, dead by this stage. This then rumbles on for a good lengthy period until a man called Ian MacDonald, a sort of a hero of mine from the late 1970s, early 1980s. He was the editor of the New Musical Express, but subsequently became an academic and a musicologist and a teacher. And he wrote two fantastic books, one of which is the best book ever written on the Beatles, called Revolution in the Head. And I know you'll dispute that to the death.
I have nothing to dispute it with.
And it's an absolutely fantastic book, which analyzes every single Beatles song in terms of its intricate internal movements and the lyrics to match, and shows how each subtle shift, every note, is conveying a meaning that is linked to the lyrics or to something that's going on in the life of the individuals at the time. He then writes a book called The New Shostakovich, which is a riposte to all of the stuff that's coming out of Russia, or out of the Soviet Union at the time. And essentially, he analyzes the whole of Shostakovich's oeuvre, note by note, and shows that every subtle shift in it is describing something within his life and responding to something within his life, and basically sets up this mythic idea of Shostakovich, the secret rebel.
So you don't buy that?
I don't buy it for a minute. And
he was just a party hack?
He was an absolute genius, confronted by a hugely oppressive system. And like anybody would do, he produced work that he wanted to do as genius work and for the drawer, and then he produced other work which he needed to put out there, for the purposes of being an artist.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the final call. All doors are now closing, and we request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. Final call, ladies and gentlemen, all doors are now closing. Thank you.
Aren't you really just putting your finger on a problem here about context, where sometimes the context in which a composer may have lived or whatever, the context, the circumstances of his life or whatever, can sometimes obliterate we our view of the work. We tend to see it through that prism. So, for instance, it's almost impossible to discuss Wagner without talking about anti-Semitism. It's almost impossible to discuss Shostakovich without the whole business of the Stalinist oppression of him and so on and so forth, having to toe the party line. But what about, let's try, can we not just park that for a moment and just look and listen to the music itself? You see, I think it's wonderful music. I think I love the Shostakovich symphonies. They're just so Russian for me. There's a sort of I use the words advisedly, a brutal quality. Now, that's used brutal in an attractive sense, and that's what I find about them. So I think it's really important for us. I think both of us perhaps are susceptible, and like many, many other people, to constantly putting the music into its context, which is just a good thing to do. But if the context begins to obliterate your appreciation of the music, then I think we're putting things backwards. We're looking through the wrong end of the telescope.
Well, now, we're going to listen now in the second half to the Shostakovich, okay? So I'll put this
now,
up
don't
to
be
you.
Pointing your finger.
Oh, I'm pointing my finger now, actually. Let me put this up to you, he says, wagging his finger.
There's people
wag.
Over there beginning to look at us.
I know, first I'm asking to hold your hand and now I'm wagging your finger at you. What's going on here?
You're going to have a drink.
So what we have coming in the second half, we'll look at the music. Then, what to me we see is a Largo, which is absolutely unbelievably beautiful, but nothing as not even a patch on Beethoven. It doesn't reach any of those soaring, romantic, interior, soulful heights at all.
Really?
But it is a wonderful piece, and it's the best part of it. For me, the Shostakovich's Fifth is three comic elements placed around a beautiful Largo. I think the second movement is almost jocosely odd and really emerges from, and I know this is not a new thing, a lot of people are saying, have said this before, but to me, I listen to the second movement with the dancers, the internal dancers, and what I'm seeing is Shostakovich, the piano player, playing along with silent films.
People beginning to turn their heads here. they're not nodding in agreement.
Well, Shostakovich, this is where he starts a lot, and has a bit of a living doing this, and that's actually important. I think that's important. The fact that he spent a lot of time improvising music to film, and is a film buff, and a lot of, you know, he scored a lot of films. So that whole second movement is basically, it looks like there's some kind of up on screen in his mind is a series of dances.
I would buy that. Yes, there is a filmic quality to that. There's no question about that. But I can't help feeling, Tomás Clancy, that you will be leaving here with me later saying, oh, that was wonderful stuff. I really do. And I believe that people will be leaving. I think you should leave tonight's concert after the Prokofiev and after the Shostakovich feeling like you've been picked up like a rag doll and shaken around the place. And you may not have enjoyed all the emotions it brought up, but you should leave, you know, in a slightly wrung out feeling. That's the way I would be. And I think you must open yourself to that tomorrow.
Well, I am opening myself to that. And I mean, I love Shostakovich. I absolutely do. I'm just not a fan of the Fifth.
You're damning with faint praise.
Yes, damning with faint praise. I think it's one of the ones where it's clearly it was the riposte to the condemnation that he received for Lady Macbeth.
What was it? The artist's response to just criticism.
To justified criticism.
Dreadful
exactly.
Phrase.
Well, so that, the question now, see, everything turns on this. Did he write that subtitle? You know, yeah. And was it put in by someone else? You know, that's the central part of this problem with Shostakovich. We just don't know how much he then did buy into all of this. Now, that doesn't make it in any way bad or good. And see, this is what I disagree with. The fact that we have to have him as a hero of the West rather than as a great Soviet composer, that's my problem with the current state of affairs. Well, Ian MacDonald, brilliant man, beautiful books, but what he's really saying is he's capturing Shostakovich for the West. He's capturing and saying that he rejected all of this and that he managed to sneak this out from the underneath of this terrible Soviet problem, this terrible Soviet regime. Whereas what I would like to think is that the regime was absolutely, you know, was a crushing and brutal regime. But in the middle, in the heart of it, somewhere, Shostakovich shines out as the kind of things that were produced within it. And there were, you know, there were positive elements to what they were trying to do. Yes, it was poisoned by Stalin. Yes, it went off the rails. But, you know, he is a great Soviet composer.
So
and
object,
that's what I object to, I think.
You're objecting to revisionism.
Yes, bourgeois capitalist revisionism, like ourselves.
Well, let's
Shall
go
we have another one.
Let's go and listen.